This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, welcome back to The Morning Run. I'm Roshan Kanesan and this is The Breakfast Grill. Every headline in the past week has been on the coronavirus and flattening the curve. And social distancing has become the main priority. However, beyond the impact it has on our daily lives, there has also been major disruption to global trade. So today we have with us on the line Alex Capri, Visiting Senior Fellow at the National University of Singapore Business School, a specialist in the global value chain. Alex, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
So, Alex, it's quite clear that the global supply chain has been severely disrupted by the coronavirus. Will things ever return to normal, or at least the current norm as we see today?
No. I think the COVID-19 phenomenon is an absolute watershed regarding globalization in general and global value chains more specifically. I think it's highlighted a couple of things. The first thing it's highlighted is that the value chains have become very, very highly concentrated in China, and that you have major markets around the world and ecosystems, if you will, that have become overly reliant on these supply chains. And we see this, for example, in the pharmaceutical industry, where it turns out that for the world's prescription drugs, for example, about 80% of the ingredients come from China and India, just two countries. For antibiotics, it's even higher percentage from China. We're seeing this play out with the shortage of masks, for example, for healthcare officials around the world. It's become a crisis because production has been too highly concentrated in one place. The second point about how COVID-19 has completely become a game changer for globalization is what it has done is it has laid bare or exposed the systemic rivalry that has been emerging between the West and China, specifically the United States and China. The trade war, which of course has been much in the news for the past couple of years, has highlighted the systemic rivalry, the systemic competition that we now have in place between the China system and the West, basically. So you have state-centric capitalism, a centrally planned economy in China versus a laissez-faire open market system in the West. We've seen the rise of techno-nationalism in particular, where we have this competition. Essentially, it's a cold war that's emerging from a technological standpoint between China and the United States. To give you an example, at the height of the outbreak of the virus in Wuhan, when basically the automotive supply chains, the global automotive supply chains had been shut down, same thing for consumer electronics. There was one sector that the government essentially mandated stay open and keep producing. In other words, bypass the lockdown and the quarantine. And that sector was semiconductors. And that highlights just how critical and how important industrial policy is in China for promoting its own technological sector, and how intense this competition is certainly for the Chinese Communist Party. So I think these types of things really start to highlight the differences. And so where this is going to go is we're going to see an acceleration of what I've been calling localization of global value chains.
What kind of ripple effects could we see from here?
So if you look at strategic industries that are essential to a country's national security, their food security, their health system, these global supply chains that have been spread out and vulnerable to these kinds of exogenous threats like pandemics will force, I think, a whole new set of policies, nationalist policies that will say to companies, you must bring these supply chains home. You must produce these strategic items at home. We have to have a self-sufficient ring-fence ecosystem. And this isn't going to play very well for a lot of big multinational companies, which you could say over the last two or three decades, they've become, you know, so globally entrenched in these so-called offshoring model that this is going to come as a shock to a lot of companies. We're still going to have big multinational companies that are absolutely global companies. But instead of having these massive, uninterrupted, huge economies of scale type supply chains, they're going to have to break those things up and they're going to have to localize.
So this kind of follows on from the U.S.-China trade war, which now seems like an eternity ago. There was already talk that manufacturers wanted to move out of, that brands wanted to move their manufacturing out of China. Do you think with all this, taking into consideration all of this, that this could be accelerated, the moving of manufacturing out of China?
Absolutely. It's an absolute accelerant. There's no question about it. I think this is the COVID-19 pandemic is completely distinct. It's different from SARS in 2003. Obviously, it's just much, much bigger. It's going to have a much bigger impact on the global economy. It simply highlights it exacerbates the trade issues between the U.S. and China, which, you know, as I've always said, it's really not a trade war that we're talking about with the U.S. and China. The trade issues are just a subset of a much, much bigger geopolitical rivalry, which is going to continue across other spheres. Even if you look at, for example, the global financial crisis, 2008, 2009, and you look at the amount of cooperation that took place, you know, amongst the G7 for sure, the G20 more broadly. And you compare that situation to today with the COVID-19 pandemic, and there's far less cooperation taking place, certainly between the U.S. and China. In fact, you can see how the relationship is probably the worst it's been in decades, with the expulsion of American journalists from China, the U.S. essentially naming Chinese media outlets essentially as extensions of the state, and you know, expelling members of those organizations. So, at a time when it would be absolutely vital to have international cooperation, certainly between the world's two largest economies, we're just not seeing it. We are definitely on a completely new track, I think, going forward, post-COVID-19.
In this Cold War between the U.S. and China, do you see globalization being split into two halves?
Well, I would say that globalization is undergoing fragmentation. That global value chains are localizing, and that from a trade perspective, I actually see multiple blocks. I see this sort of fragmentation into really three different blocks. I think the first would be what I would call the fair trade bloc or the multilateralist type bloc. And that is essentially what we've been seeing with the coalition of the willing, where you see the European Union engaging with Japan and Singapore and Vietnam in these very, very progressive, deep free trade agreements. And similarly, we see the CPTPP with a coalition of the remaining 11 countries minus the United States pushing ahead with very similar progressive framework of rules. I think that represents a strong interest in sort of a multilateralist approach with very westernized values baked into the rule system. I think the other sort of block or chunk of trading countries or regimes, if you will, that are forming is what I would call the China Incorporated or the China Inc. model, which is, of course, China at the center of this collection of trading countries. And of course, the Belt and the Road Initiative is something that would link these countries together through infrastructure and trade. And the rules in that group would reflect essentially the China way of doing business. So the things that I've just mentioned in the multilateral fair trade Western kind of model, I think would not be prevalent. And then I think the third sort of model is everyone for himself, basically. You know, you enter into bilateral trade agreements with everyone, a la, post-Brexit Britain, or, Mr. Trump's America First model, where, it's very nationalist. It eschews multilateralist type arrangements. So again, all this underscores the trends that I've been talking about for years now, which we've been seeing in the global system, which is fragmentation.
And considering that China represents about 16% of world GDP at this point, with a market of about 1.3 billion people who are also global consumers now, how does this factor in? Do you foresee a large chunk of this new supply system being catered to the Chinese market, or will it be split along those lines that you already mentioned?
Well, it'll be split, but China will remain a very important market for multinational companies everywhere because of its size, because it's so big, and because of the increased domestic consumption that's happening in China. But as I said earlier, to do this now, to play in that sandbox, so to speak, companies are going to have to adopt an in-China, for-China structure and increasingly supply chain, because from a strategic standpoint, certain strategic supply chains are going to decouple because of this increasing rivalry between China and the U.S. and China and the West.
And in the meantime, there are signs that China's economy is coming back to life after what has been quite a disastrous industrial production numbers in January and February, down 13% versus street expectations of just 3%, and retail sales completely just falling off there. How soon do you think will Chinese manufacturing come back on track?
That's really hard to say, because you know there'll be Chinese manufacturing for the domestic market, so it depends how quickly the domestic market comes back, and then there's Chinese manufacturing for export markets, and you know, it's all going to depend on how quickly governments around the world are able to get a handle on this COVID-19 pandemic, and you know how they're able to curtail the negative economic effects. So it really is difficult to predict that.
Even if manufacturing does ramp up, how much does the demand shock factor into this, especially now with concerns over consumption in the US and Europe?
We are seeing the biggest, most significant drop in consumer demand since the Second World War. It depends how long this situation persists, how effectively governments can step in and infuse their systems with not only money but with confidence, and they can shore up and extend sort of bridging loans and bridging finance to the various organizations. So it's really going to be difficult to gauge how that happens. It's also going to be interesting to see how certain governments, including the U.S. government under the Trump administration, go forward in the next 2 to 4 weeks regarding lockdown versus asking people to go back to work. So all of this is still in play.
I've been speaking to Alex Capri, visiting senior fellow at the National University of Singapore Business School. When we come back, we'll be getting into the possible benefits that other countries could get in the supply chain if manufacturing gets decentralized from China. We'll be right back. This is The Breakfast Grill on BFM 89.9.
You are listening to The BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Welcome back to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kunnison, and this morning I'm speaking to Alex Capri, visiting senior fellow at the National University of Singapore Business School. Now, Alex, when we left off, we were talking about the fragmentation in the supply chain. With this fragmentation, the big question, I guess, now is if manufacturing becomes less concentrated in China, who stands to benefit from this?
Well, look, first of all, there's no country in Southeast Asia that's going to replace China. Let's be clear about that, right? Simply because of the scale of China's market and its infrastructure and its manufacturing capacity. But there will be countries that will continue to see the transition of supply chains out of China into their markets, such as Vietnam, for example, to I think also Malaysia, certainly around consumer electronics and some other areas, and Singapore, I think will also benefit because of its unique attributes, as a financial logistics and innovation hub. So what we'll really see again is we will see this breaking up of company operations, where they will look to have redundancies and where they will look to have capacity in different markets. that are ring fenced. So they might still continue to have an operation specifically geared towards China in China, but then they don't want to be completely reliant on that. And we've seen how the COVID-19 virus has exposed over reliance on Chinese supply chains. So they need companies will need to have a China plus one, China plus two, China plus three strategy. They will have to completely decouple certain strategic supply chains from China that will fall under the export control regimes of various countries, whether it's the United States or whether it's European countries or many other countries under the Wassenaar arrangement for dual use goods. So yes, we will see supply chains being diversified, and we will see certain redundancies. And of course, depending on how quickly automation and robotics are able to facilitate the operation of factories in local markets, we will see more and more automation taking place in production lines.
So, Alex, as manufacturing changes, not just within Asia, but overall, which countries do you see standing out? You made the point earlier that there's no way that any other country in Southeast Asia will displace China as the central hub in the region. But outside of Southeast Asia, which countries do you think will see a lot of benefit from this?
From an emerging markets perspective, Mexico is seeing and will continue to see the return of a lot of assembly and manufacturing that will be reshored from as far away as China. Depending on the industry, I think the U.S. and the EU will see the return of factories. I mean, Tesla is talking about building a gigafactory in Europe and one in the United States, perhaps in Texas. I think there'll be political pressure, certainly in the context of this U.S.-China technology cold war, to move high tech out of places like Taiwan into the United States. I mean, the U.S. government is already pressuring TSMC, which is a large Taiwanese contract manufacturing producer of microchips, to move and to build an entire production facility in the United States on national security grounds and so forth. So I expect to see more of that.
Do you have any thoughts on how a company, let's use Apple, would have to change their operations on a global level?
I do see Apple playing a role in the future in terms of new consortiums of companies coming together to try and address these things that I've been talking about and to produce products within these ring-fenced environments. So I fully expect to see companies like Apple, SpaceX, and other big non-state actors that are either going to be compelled through new regulations and policies to participate, for example, in R&D consortiums and production consortiums, and to reorganize supply chains around different policy objectives, as well as voluntary and market-driven decisions by companies like Apple to get into new sectors and to locate production in certain places. And as I mentioned, we're not there yet, but when the technology gets to the point to where you can have a fully automated plant, companies like Apple are going to take advantage of that to produce as close to their local markets as possible.
Do you think there is any way to encourage global cooperation and prevent this fragmentation from happening?
No. The last three decades of globalization as we know it are over. Those heady days of completely unimpeded offshoring model are over.
And do you think this will be net positive or negative in terms of economic output going forward?
Oh, I don't necessarily think that it's going to be net negative on economic output. I think there are all kinds of signs that, GDP can still continue to increase, even though it's less reliant, for example, on global trade. If you have more productivity and more production on a local scale, and actually we've seen an interesting change in the correlation between the growth of global trade and the growth of local economies post-global financial crises. Prior to that, there was always a corresponding link between growth in global trade and growth in global economy. So if global trade went up, 3% or 4%, then there would be a corresponding sort of uptick in growth that you could really track, right? You could track it. They would be in line and in sync. After the financial crisis, when trade flatlined or dipped and then flatlined, you didn't necessarily see a corresponding lack of growth in GDP. Why is that? Well, because economies were growing through different means, and a lot of it was local, and a lot of it was the involvement or the growth of more consumers and more small businesses in local economies because of e-commerce, the sharing economy, access to the internet, and sort of the digital revolution in general, and of course the growth of the informal economies, which are also being driven by these new technologies. So it doesn't necessarily mean that if we see a slowdown or an interruption in volumes of cross-border trade that we're going to see a corresponding drop in economic growth. But there's no question that when you have free and open cross-border trade, that it, the net effect is absolutely positive in terms of the, you know, the ability to be able to trade across borders.
So, Alex, is it fair to say that globalization as we know it is essentially dead, and we're going to be entering a new phase after this?
Yeah, I don't like the word dead, but I would say that we are absolutely a new phase of globalization, and we are to a certain degree deglobalizing from the system as we've known it, but we are producing other types of growth on a regional and a local basis. And we're still going to see global value chains. There's no question about that. But they will just have these new characteristics that I've been describing.
So with all this in mind, for a country like Malaysia, what lessons or opportunities are there from this, this fragmentation and this disruption to global supply chains?
Yeah. So I think Malaysia can learn from a country like Singapore, for example, in that what makes Singapore so unique is that from a governance and a corporate good governance perspective, it provides a really inviting environment for foreign companies to come in. It has what I call the five T's. It's transparent, which produces a certain amount of trust and truth within the business framework. It has another T for technology, meaning that it's got great infrastructure, it's got hard and soft infrastructure, it's attracted critical mass of innovative companies and logistics companies, financial services companies, and most importantly, capacity building type professional companies, right, with that expertise. And it has talent. It's attracted really good talent in all the key sectors. And it's very, very well connected. You know, if you look at the number of free trade agreements that Singapore has with the rest of the world, you know, it's hyper connected. So it's got all those 5T attributes with the right kind of connectivity. And that's what I think a country like Malaysia needs to work on, because that will make it a much more attractive market and location for a broad range of companies. You know, that will make it certainly one of the alternate destinations for a lot of the supply chains and investment that is sort of refocusing and looking for a new home.
All right. Thank you so much for joining me on the line today, Alex.
Pleasure.
I've been speaking with Alex Capri, visiting senior fellow at the National University of Singapore Business School. I'm Roshan Kennison, and you've been listening to The Breakfast Grill. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.